This is a three-year project where RTI is supporting the Division of Quarantine. We are about 1 year into it, just over. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of provide the back bookend where Gabrielle Benenson sort of provided the overall introduction. Then we have sort of three chapters of some of the in-depth work that the division is doing. And then I'm sort of going to cover some of that and then lead to where they're going and how RTI is supporting them. So let me acknowledge my co-authors. You have met four of them here. And then I have two people who I'm working with very closely at RTI, Brian Evans and Erica Willisey. So the first question that you probably were thinking is, well, why a needs assessment? We had that wonderful slide that Gabby and David had that had the process that they undergo with a needs assessment, development, pilot testing, evaluation, et cetera. So as Gabby mentioned, that there's been incredible growth in the division from 8 to 20 stations with a lot of new staff, as well as there's certainly been a lot of media attention about current issues going on related to quarantine. And so that's led to the need for more training, and as Gabby stated, that one of the best ways to do that is to start with the needs assessment. Similarly, there are many different groups that work together at ports of entry, and there's a different slide on that, so I'm not going to go into them. And as Gabby mentioned also, that the branches of admission explicitly calls for partnership. So there are different components of this needs assessment, and I feel like I'm waving in and out on the microphone, so I'm going to try to stand very close to it. If I'm too loud, let me know. There's a stakeholder work group, which is very important. There are many different groups involved, and so that really helps to get buy-in and to obtain synergy across all the different groups. We have key informant interviews with people who are involved in communication and training, roundtable discussions with our non-federal stakeholders, the cruise lines, the airlines, EMS, Customs and Border Protection, a web-based survey with frontline staff members, and focus groups with international travelers and physicians. And we're going to talk a little bit about all of those. Okay, so here's our stakeholder work group. There are 10 federal and non-federal groups who participate in monthly calls. Of course, our lead, the Centers for Disease Control. We have IATA out of Canada, which is international and domestic airlines, cruise lines, CLIA, Customs and Border Protection, Border Patrol, TSA, customs brokers, EMS, Fisheries and Wildlife, and the USDA Inspection Service. So the work group helps voice the concerns of constituents. They help provide advice on the instrument designs of our key informant interviews and eventually for the web-based survey. They're helping to identify the people who should we be interviewing with the key informant interviews. They're helping us to plan the needs assessment and how to best get that survey out to frontline people. And then they're going to help us eventually to review the findings and to craft recommendations. Our key informant interviews, they're almost all qualitative. They're again with persons who are involved in training and communication. And that's with each of those different groups that you saw. So speaking with key people who are involved in training for the cruise lines, speaking with key people who are involved in training for Customs and Border Protection, et cetera. And then we have roundtable discussions. Again, qualitative in nature. And hopefully people involved in training, but also some heads of office, and some supervisors, frontline staff. So getting a sort of a broad picture about what's out there. And one of the two components that we've completed so far is some roundtables with EMS staff. So we're going to, there's a couple slides about that later on. We have planned a web-based survey with our federal partner agencies to assess the needs of frontline staff, the training preferences of frontline staff, and different topics that they're interested in. And we've already completed a frontline survey of CDC Quarantine and Border Health Services branch staff to help with their annual annual training session, as well as just to look at other areas where that group is interested. So not exclusively for that annual training. And then we're planning focus groups with primary care physicians and adult international travelers. So one of the things that Rebecca had mentioned was that with these travel health alert notices, that a lot of them haven't been tested, so we don't know necessarily what physicians are going to do with them. So that's one of the things that we're going to look with the focus groups. The topics that are investigated are public health roles. As several of the people mentioned that, especially David, when talking about training for Customs and Border Protection, that public health function that they do is not their primary role, and so they don't necessarily recognize that they have a public health role. So that's one of the things that we want to assess, how they perceive that and their self-efficacy to help perform that job role. There are barriers to public health action, and those might not be, they might be perceived barriers, that might be actual barriers. CDC consistently wants them to work through their established protocols, and so the way is to figure out how can notifying CDC of a given issue become part of their protocol. Different channels and formats for communication and education, health topics of interest in case training related to quarantine and border health can be tied into other topics, and of course opportunities for collaboration. So as I mentioned, we've completed two different areas, we're in the middle of the roundtable discussions, but we've already completed the web-based survey of just CDC field staff, and then we're engaged in a series of roundtable discussions with various partners, and we've completed two EMS discussions, one in New Orleans with firefighters who work at airports, and one with both land and air border ports of entry and the quarantine stations who work with them in a meeting in Atlanta. So what was the purpose of the quarantine staff survey? Well, to assess training methods, preferred training methods such as do they want lecture? Do they want case studies? Do they want field staff to discuss their experiences? Training topics, so diseases of significance, surveillance, etc. The frequency of the training, annual, biannual, how often staff feel that they should be trained, and the location of the training, in person in Atlanta, in a regional location, online on their own, etc. It was a web-based survey. We had about an 82% response rate, and it was conducted earlier this year. And again, we assessed training type and method, and we found out that it really depends on topic. The length of time that somebody had been employed by CDC, their years of expertise, et cetera, that didn't matter. What mattered was the topic. That training topic was what determined how often they wanted it and the type of training they wanted with it. There was an overall preference for a lecture format and for opportunities to share their experiences across all topics, but the type of method overall was dependent upon the topic. With the EMS roundtable discussions, they were semi-structured, open-ended discussions facilitated by RTI and CDC quarantine staff. Again, we had a meeting in Atlanta with 65 different people, and then another one in New Orleans with 10 different people. So some of the results from that, I mean, it was very interesting. It really showed that EMS workers would really like clear protocols for response to a public health situation. They would say, you know, well, just tell us what to do. They requested a job aid. They liked the idea of having a job aid. Not all of them wanted a ring card, such as David showed. Others said that they preferred stickers that could be stuck on oxygen tanks, etc. So, I mean, it was very rewarding to have the discussions to get a lot of diversity and suggestions. They voiced a need for training and education, and they provided a number of different opportunities for collaboration. They highlighted the key role of the medical director within their organizations for providing information to EMS, that one of the best things that CDC could do was work through all the state medical directors, and the state medical directors will make sure that the information gets down to them. And they voiced a need for the key active outreach from quarantine stations, that many of the people who were in cities where there were quarantine stations knew exactly who to call, but many of the places from the satellite places in different cities were not sure exactly who their quarantine station was. So what are our next steps? Our next steps are to continue our roundtable discussions with airlines, cruise lines, and customs brokers, and they all have different, slightly different public health roles. And of course, they have different opportunities for training, etc. Key informant interviews, we've completed 3 so far, and we've got a long series left to go of people who we will interview who are involved in training and communication for their frontline staff. We have the web-based survey of our federal partners, and then CDC is going to use the results of their staff survey for their training, and they're using the results of the EMS training, the EMS roundtables, to help develop tools. And so eventually that will happen again with the airlines, the cruise lines, and the customs brokers, etc., where they move next after the needs assessment around that circle to materials development and pilot testing, etc. Thank you.
I'd like to open the floor up for questions if anybody has them. Yes, please, go ahead. Repeat the questions for everyone. There was a lot there, but there's a lot of good statements and a lot of good advice from state and local health departments about, and please help me with remembering everything, but for instance, for travelers coming from Tokyo, many of these should be translated into the languages, and indeed, during SARS, they were translated into 7 languages. And I think, though, the first step is developing them into plain language in English so they can be easily translated. So that's the first step, and that doesn't disavow translation at all. That is the first step. So I welcome that comment. And yeah, the doctor instructions are specific to the disease and where they can also get more
information.
Yes, and that's, well, okay, so about the doctor part of the information is that we need to do more needs assessment among physicians, which we have not done yet, so hopefully that will address the concern. And then there was a
third part was, instead of just giving it to passengers who happened to have been sitting near someone who knew when they got off the plane at measles, you should be giving it to people who are coming from places where there are people out there. That's so
typical. Okay.
Right. So actually, what
let's repeat that. Yeah.
Right.
I'll let you do that.
So what you're bringing up about the that there's actually multiple uses for the travel health alert notice. Our sort of standard method of distribution is when we identify someone who has symptoms that give us an idea that they might have an illness of one of the illnesses we're concerned about. So it's not a confirmation that they have been diagnosed with that illness, but that they may have fever and rash or something that gives us an idea. We would pass that out to the persons on the plane who were exposed to that individual. The other way that this is used or distributed is around outbreak situations. And SARS is a very nice example of that, actually, because we had an idea of what was going on with the epidemic, what countries SARS was going on in, that people were were going to be traveling to the United States from, we actually targeted all of those flights that were coming from those countries, and those were handed out to every single passenger who came off of that plane. So it has a dual use for a sort of isolated, specific incidents where we have a good idea of someone who has an illness and we think these persons were exposed here, or in broader situations where there's an outbreak going on where we actually can hand it out or use it as a way of educating all of the persons who may have been coming from that country where the outbreak was occurring. In the measles outbreak in Europe at that time, we actually produced 9,000 measles cards, distributed them to all of our stations to use if necessary for flights for persons returning from Europe. As it turns out, we actually didn't have many measles cases come out of that situation, but they were available for folks to distribute. So this is one of the challenges that we have to work with as a training team. We rely on our epi folks and scientists at CDC to give us advice about when there's enough of a risk and for us to actually be distributing or disseminating this to everybody. And when do we have to sort of strike a balance between over-distribution and dissemination and when it's all really going to provide a sort of effective response or actually increase reporting notification and getting folks to the right services. So for the outbreak going on in Tokyo, we actually had a discussion at CDC about that and talked with our colleagues who work specifically with measles in immunizations and discussed about whether we wanted to do a full-blown campaign around communicating to travelers. And a decision was made that this wasn't the time, maybe not yet. They're keeping an eye on what's going on there. So I rely on them to know what they're doing, to give us the advice and when we need to implement our strategies, and we're developing things so that we have them available so we can do it when that decision's made. But you make a very good point. Yeah. I think I saw over here first.
Again, I thank you for the presentation. I have two points. One, what's the purpose of the exit screening? And is it a fringe on civil liberty? And two, once the person is identified, do you have any protection of not making it a criminal action on the part of either the CDC or afterward the local authorities on that individual or whoever is infected? Because some local authorities, they put that person in jail and definitely refuse to let any kind of medical care to that person. What's the step after quarantine?
So these were questions.
Circumstances with the situation warranted. That was in conjunction with a decision with many people at CDC and other federal agencies. So only in certain circumstances. Furthermore, I would say that it would be not really in the realm of a legal authority for anybody to be said they were a criminal because of their behavior. So I don't think we would. I don't have anything to address that. I'm going to stop talking. Because I'm not really saying anything. Gabby, do you want to address this?
The reason is because in Arizona we had the TB individual where he had to go to Texas upon his return, was arrested, and again they went through the whole legal system. Now, I could see why we need some quarantine, but we have to protect the civil liberty of our clients.
Right. It's a delicate balance.
Right. what you're bringing up, I need to first say, I am not a lawyer. We have an Office of Global Counsel at CDC who are fabulous, and they are really the right persons to ask sort of the legal, answer the legal-related questions about these issues. But what you're bringing up are very, it's sort of a special thing, actually, about our group at CDC. We actually have federal regulations and legal authority to do what we do, which is really special. You don't get that in a lot of places in public health. Recently, we've had a lot of excitement around a particular TB case, and several TB cases have been coming up. And there are also state and local legal authorities that exist for protecting the health of the public that are determined based on those state and local authorities. So in your situation, in your example, the courts there can actually issue, based on recommendations or requests from maybe the state medical officer, a court order for an individual who may not have been complying with their regimen, may have been, you usually have to actually prove, because of the balance between civil liberties, you actually have to prove that this person has not been complying, has not listened to recommendations, and actually document that. So it's not done easily, and that's on purpose. We actually put a lot of things in place in our legal system to try and protect, from a public health standpoint, to try and protect the rights of that individual. There is a very fine balance. We want to protect the health of the public, and we want to do whatever we can to do that. We also don't want to infringe on individual rights. So it's a sensitive issue, and we try very hard not to do that. Every time we make a decision, we try and think about all of those things. We call our lawyers. We talk to them. Are you sure? Is this okay? Are we making sure that the right information is communicated so they're informed about what's happening and why that's happening, and that they're a part of the process? So you bring up a very important point, and I wish we had our lawyers here. Yes.
Process look like? Well, what it basically is that the CBP officer is, if they suspect that there is a public health event, whether that's an ill person or a dog without its rabies vaccination, etc., they are required to notify their supervisor, their CBP supervisor, who will then determine is this significant enough to notify us, and then that individual will then call the quarantine station, and if it's after hours, there will be an on-call officer who will then answer it. So the idea is to reduce the burden from the CBP officer to make any sort of judgment on, you know, what that person may have, etc., and then let the public health authorities make a judgment. I don't know, but I, having been giving this presentation for about 2 years and have talked with the officer, so my informal judgment is that it varies widely. There are a number of people who have master's degrees in criminal justice, and there are those who are former military as well as a former TSA, et cetera, or law enforcement.
Some of them seem to be That is exactly why it's still in development. It says draft on it because the illness description that is on the ring card is pulled directly from our federal regulations. However, clearly swollen glands is not something you can readily see, although rash might be. So we're in the process of developing a better set of criteria to assist them because we know that they are not clinicians and they are not going to be, most likely not taking temperatures or anything like that. So you've hit on one of our largest challenges in trying to translate criteria for medical inclusion as an ill traveler versus someone who is principally a law enforcement officer to help guide that. So what we tell them in training is that if you are concerned, if you are worried about this person, give us a call, and then we'll make a judgment. We have medical officers on call 24 hours, etc. They can then make that assessment. So we try to set the bar quite low to reduce that burden on them. It would vary depending on whether it's an onboard response. I'll repeat the question. So the question was, what is the response time for an ill traveler? And the answer would be it varies. If the person is on board the aircraft and that aircraft is at a port of entry where a quarantine station exists, it would be different than if it's at a subport and they would need to call in. Either EMS would be on the scene and they would call in to us, as well as if it's after hours, it may take a few more minutes to get that person paged, etc. So it may vary. So within my colleague says within 15 minutes is our. We have medical officers on call, so even if the individual who is responding to the sick person is not a clinician or they have an MPH or et cetera, they can contact the medical officer, and they do, to get further guidance. I think it's also important to note that our primary goal is a public health assessment. We're not diagnosing the person on board the aircraft. We're not diagnosing them in the terminal. That's something for a physician to do with the clinical support. So our goal is, are they a risk to the people around them? Is our immediate.
Time is up, but I just want to point out that if you expect state and local health departments to be in a certain capacity, you're really disappointed. Because in a pandemic, we don't have any time to go to the airport and screen and come and try.
list that I think in Amanda's slide showed, she actually had several different audiences, and we understand that if when we're in a stage where we're actually requesting surge capacity, HHS is going to be assisting us with trying to identify folks who are available who could try to help immediately. The other thing is to think about what we're doing outside of just a pandemic influenza scenario, but if there's another event, it might not be as big as a pandemic, but that we need some assistance with, all of these folks might be able to help us out, and if we get them trained early and they get us an idea of what's going on at our stations and what we need, they might be able to provide some support.
Honestly, we're never going to be screening in front of the traveler. It's not going to happen. I mean,
right, and the role of the different partners who are involved in providing assistance may be very different from the basics that were provided, like visual screening. We may actually be working with the local health departments for the other side of this. We identify folks, and we're sending them to you. FYI, this is where they're coming from and what they've been through. So, you know, you're right. We're going to have to adjust and adapt based on the situation, who's available to help, and what it is we're asking for.